You're a SaaS founder. You've built something solid, but growth still feels harder than it should. Most SaaS companies don't fail because of bad tech. They fail because they've never become a must-have to the right customer. This podcast is here to change that. I'm Ton Dobbe, and this is the Remarkable SaaS Podcast. Every week, I talk to founders in the trenches, facing friction, making bold moves, and building companies that last. We dig into real choices around focus, positioning, customer pool, team alignment, the things that separate forgettable software from the ones that people can't live without. No hype, no hacks. Just honest conversations to help you build something that people would miss if it was gone. If your SaaS should be indispensable but isn't yet, this is your podcast. Let's get into it. The guest on my podcast this week is Mariano García Valiño, founder and CEO of Axenya.
It's one thing to actually see the problem and find a technical solution for the problem. It's a different thing to deploy it in the right place and within a very complex value chain that has a lot of the incentives that are not well aligned.
This is Mariano. We dig into how he spent 18 months proving his preventive healthcare model reduces costs by 20%, and then discovered clinical proof meant nothing without someone willing to pay for it. You'll hear how he rejected selling to insurers, doctors, and patients, and instead bought a healthcare broker to change who he served, employers who actually bear the cost and have the time frame to benefit. The conversation reveals why the right solution dies without the right buyer, and how changing your business model matters more than perfecting your product. Well, hi, Mariano. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Well, hi, Tom. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, well, there's so many things that were triggers that went up when I saw your profile. I said, okay, we have to talk, we have to do... to hear the story about the company that you founded and also a little bit about your background.
Sure.
How these things connect. So before we start talking about the company that you founded, Axenya, a little bit about you. What drives you? What gives you energy as an entrepreneur?
I think it has been changed over the years. Axenya is my fourth company. So at the beginning, it was a lot about curiosity and solving problems and things like that. I think over time, there is a drive in me more about impact and what we can do to change big problems. So for our first company, it was a private equity play. It was all about efficiency. And then, it was intellectually interesting. I don't think we were changing the world in any case. We were just giving the same product but more efficiently, and that's great for investors, but it didn't change the world much. I think for Axenya is a lot about there is a huge problem with healthcare affordability. Unless we solve it, it's going to collapse. And I believe that once you actually have a solution for one of those, or you think you have a solution for one of those big problems, you have a moral imperative to try to make it happen, right? So I think that today is much more about that.
Yeah. So you said four companies. You indeed worked for a company called Advent, which I happen to know because they were also one of the investors, actually the investor in Unit 4, a company that I used to work for. And I recognize what you're saying about efficiency and about profitability and these type of things. Not so much the thinking about like, let's change the world. So it's fascinating how you then at some point make the decision to say, hey, I see a problem, and you just already highlighted what problem you saw. And I agree, it's a big one. Healthcare indeed collapsing if we don't do anything. So why did you believe it was the right moment to take on that problem?
So it's the problem has been there for a long time. I agree, and it has been signaled for people way more important and intelligent than I am. So we've been talking about value-based medicine for over two decades, but we haven't been able to implement that. And I think that the major thing is you really need two things to attack the problem. I think that the healthcare has a lot of tiny problems, but a very big one. And the very big one is that the nature of the diseases we're up against has changed dramatically. So we defined the healthcare system to fight against mostly acute diseases because that's what was killing people in the half of the last century. And we have actually been very successful against that. So modern medicine has pretty much gave us 30 more years of life expectancy since that time until today. And this, most of that is due to vaccines and antibiotics because we have been able to conquer the bugs that were getting us sick. But when you conquer that, the other things start up appearing, right? Diabetes, high blood pressure, all the metabolic diseases, all those things are not bugs that are attacking us. And the body is not very good at letting us know that we actually have a problem. So when you compare, you have an infectious disease, you very, very clearly have fever, you have pain, you have other stuff that would drive you to the doctor very quickly. When you have diabetes, you can be with diabetes for sometimes decades before you actually have any symptom. And same thing happens with high blood pressure and all things like that. So the whole design doesn't work. So you actually have to go after the patients instead of waiting for the patients to come to you. And going after the patients requires two things: high capacity of monitoring stuff and high capacity of analyzing that stuff. So we've had high capacity of monitoring patients since maybe 15 years ago. We started with the first wearable, so not perfect, but started there. But we haven't been able to analyze that efficiently up until maybe 5 years ago. So the conjunction of the ability to capture a lot of data plus the ability to analyze a lot of data because we have AI and other tools like that, I think it actually gives us the opportunity of catching diseases early, which we have been talking about for 2 decades, but it's very difficult to catch them early unless you deploy a huge amount of human effort. Now you can do it without human effort or with less human effort. So you can drive to the doctor's people earlier, and this is actually a twofold advantage. So you will start spending less money because you catch people early. So if you catch someone at the first stages of diabetes, it's a lot less expensive to treat. So and the person will be healthier for a longer time. So it's a win-win.
Exactly. Yeah. I completely agree with that. So you saw sort of that perfect wave building up. About
Yeah,
the
that's kind of a problem I saw. Then building a solution is, of course, a different thing. You
Yeah.
go, changing and being driven mostly by curiosity and things like that. You don't know if it's going to work. 9 times out of 10, it doesn't. So it takes a while for you to get the right angle on that. But that's what started me.
So how do you go about that? Because one of the quotes I saw about you, that you are a visionary leader capable of identifying business opportunities that most will miss. And you
So,
already used the word curiosity, which happens to be trait number four in my book, The Remarkable Effect. So there is something that is, that
So I think
requires that curiosity.
I agree, and I think the whole reason why I started Axenia, it was about curiosity. I thought it was, basically we have a $10 trillion industry in the world. It's growing. The cost of healthcare is growing 2.5 times faster than inflation. It's pretty obvious that it's gonna blow up, right? Unless we do something. And what I realized is, there is this angle now, and I didn't really know how to exploit it because in healthcare, it's one thing to actually see the problem and find a technical solution for the problem. It's a different thing to deploy it in the right place and within a very complex value chain that has a lot of the incentives that are not well aligned. So we and it was probably the nerd in me that started the company, is basically saying, how do we solve this? And we spent about a year and a half just solving the problem, and we did it that experimentally within clinical research, which is a very difficult then thing to scale because you go to one hospital, very, very motivated doctors, very motivated patients. So, but we had to see if it worked. So we started monitoring those patients and intervening early and to send them to the doctors beforehand. And clinically it was wonderful. So we published a paper in 2023, I believe, in diabetes technology that said, you are able, if you monitor patients, diabetes patients at that time, frequently, and you send them to the doctors earlier with very simple algorithms at that time, you can save about 20% cost. You can reduce the risk of them dying from diabetes by about 18%. You can reduce the risk of having a stroke and heart disease and all that. And at that time, I basically said, "Well, this is magic. Everyone's going to want that." We spent another year without selling one single dime because we couldn't find anyone that actually cared. So
Exactly.
you have things like, you go to the insurance providers, and in theory, they will spend less money if they deploy your solution. But there's a time factor, right? They actually are covering a person for a limited amount of time, and biologic processes are longer than that. So say you go to an insurance today and tell them, you have a whatever, 20% of your population is suffering from obesity. So if we treat them, we're going to reduce cost. And they will tell you, "I agree with you, but you will reduce cost in a time where I'm not covering them. So why would I actually spend money today for someone else to save money later?" It took us a long while to actually find a solution. We found a solution through the employers in Brazil. And
Employers.
and I emphasize employers in Brazil because the way it works in Brazil is similar to the US. It wouldn't work in Spain, for example. So the healthcare coverage actually gets paid by employers. Almost 100% of it gets paid by employers. And employers actually can negotiate with insurance the price based on their historical claim ratio. So if they have a better management of the population, they pay less of an insurance the following year. So all of a sudden, you have someone that actually cares because they pay for it, and they have enough time frame in their mind so that they say, "I can invest today and I will pick the rewards tomorrow." And it worked for Brazil.
Let me make a small interruption here. Mariano just made a critical remark that sets his approach apart from most mission-driven startups. Seeing the difference between solving a huge global problem versus an expensive local problem. It doesn't matter that everybody agrees healthcare affordability is a massive problem. Agreement alone doesn't create buyers. The breakthrough came when he stopped pitching the huge social problem and instead identified who suffers the expensive problem right now and has the urgency and the budget to solve it. And this is what remarkable software companies do. They acknowledge they cannot please everyone. They master the art of curiosity, and then they aim to be different, not just better. Want to master these traits as well? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
So we went, we actually bought a broker who is the agent that actually sells insurance to the employers. And we bought a company that was 25,000 lives at that time. We're at 100 and something today, and it worked. Now you can say, can I actually take this and make it work in the UK where the NHS controls everything? Probably not, because the employers don't pay for it. So we'd have to find another way for NHS to buy that. Or in Spain, where healthcare is mostly paid by the provincial government. So it would not
It's funny.
work. So you have to find the right solution for each country in many ways.
Yeah, I think it's even worse, or it's even broader than that. I mean, I talk a lot about problem definition, and a lot of companies can, of course, solve a particular problem, but where you solve the problem best and where actually then people start caring and not caring is about context. And you're giving the exact or the perfect example about what context was really about in this case. It was about who actually cared about the expense. I've worked with some companies that sort of were on a mission solving a huge social problem, and I think this is one of them again. Everybody agrees this is a very big problem, and we need to do something about it. But if it's only about this huge problem, and no one feels that connection about, yeah, but what can I do about it? You have to bring it down to the expensive problem, and this in this case was the expensive problem is for the employers.
I agree. I agree. If you keep it in, this is a great humanity problem. Yeah, we all care, but are we going to do something? We always feel very small to actually
Exactly.
act on climate change or whatever. We all agree with that, but we're not making a lot of progress. And I think it's partially because we haven't yet found who is actually the party that is going to suffer the consequences if we don't solve it. And I think
For
in this
who is it
case,
urgent?
yeah, for who is it urgent, and for who is actually going to pay for it? And in climate change, I don't think we have found that yet,
No,
at least not
exactly.
everywhere. And sometimes the issue is that this is not global. So we found someone that actually cares in Brazil. Probably it would work in the US as well. Maybe in Mexico, nowhere else in the Americas. And then in Europe, you have most of the healthcare in the hands of the state, which is a good system, by the way. And I'd love for that to be everywhere else, but unfortunately that makes you having to convince someone that is very bureaucratic and very slow and with all this fragmentation. So you have to find another way of actually someone caring.
Exactly. So it's the huge dilemma, because I mean that's how, of course, a lot of startups start. They understand that they see a problem, they want to solve it, they solve it, and then there's no market for it, or at least no one who cares enough to pay. It's
I
I mean
agree, I agree.
in my book I'm talking about a triangle, the three big questions that need to be answered in terms of someone that will buy or will not buy. It's a very simple system, is it a valuable problem, and everybody in this case will agree. Is it an urgent or a critical problem? And a lot of them will now say, no, it's not for me. And then can you solve it in a way that exceeds their expectation? And if any one of those three questions is a no, you got a very, very tough life as an entrepreneur. So
Yeah,
it's
really. Agree,
exactly.
agree,
So,
and the thing. Sorry,
yeah.
go ahead.
Now, what intrigues me, because you had all these options, you saw the bigger picture, you also understood the context through experimentation almost. What have you done then, back when you started to design the system that now appears to be, sort of the driver for the success that you're seeing?
I think it actually goes back to your 10 traits. I think that the first thing that we saw is, I think your number one is you cannot please everyone. And I think we clearly saw that we didn't have the resources to build a product in enough variety so that it would please everyone. And then we decided we're going to go for mostly service companies, mostly in São Paulo, and mostly companies that have around 1,000 to 10,000 people inside. And there is a reason for that. And of course, that when you talk about that to an investor, they always say, oh, well, now you've reduced a market that was this big to something this small. But
Exactly. Yeah. Who cares?
it's exactly what you need to do, right? So that therefore you can have a lot of impact in that market, and then we'll grow. But the reason we went very big is because then we have a lot of data, and then your algorithms actually evolve faster when you have a lot of data. If you go small, it's very difficult to actually get that going. The reason we went with service is because normally if you deal with companies that have long populations in factories, you have to deal with mobile technology that is not new or is not perfect, and then some people have to choose between downloading your software or keeping their kids' pictures and things like that. And unfortunately, it's a reality you have to live with in Brazil. So then you cannot deploy your software into them, and you start seeing all those problems with old versions and things of that sort. And São Paulo is the largest city in Brazil. If you actually try to gather a lot of territory, then you start burning cash, and you cannot have impact in that. So I think one of the things that clearly changed it is we're going to focus on this few people, and they're trying to find, and this is sometimes boils down to one person. So we try to find someone that is a believer that will want to take the risk. So when they hire us, they are hiring either us or Marsh, which is the largest broker in the world and has 150 years. So you have to find someone that actually is willing to take that risk, and most people won't. You have to find someone that is actually driven enough by the future so that they will give you a chance.
It's the innovators on the Rogers bell curve, right? It's that part. But what you said, what you pointed out about please not being able to please everybody, and you highlighted in this case there is a resource problem. You cannot please everybody. But there's also this other thing around it that you said we need to kind of create a system that actually people love. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's not enough that you solve the problem. They have to love the way you solve the problem, right? Because you have to completely change the way they are behaving. So if you just solve the problem, unless you can demonstrate that this is going to have huge impact on them, and this an impact can be savings, it can be human, it can be that they just love the way it's designed, like Apple or things like that, or the way it behaves or whatever. It has to be someone that they feel, I really love this stuff and I really don't cannot live without it. So things like NPS, which it's not a perfect metric, but in healthcare, or particularly if people don't love you, they won't trust you with their data. They're trusting you with one of the most important things that they have, right? Their health and their data and that stuff. And unless they trust you with the data, privacy laws, you cannot access one single bit of data
Absolutely.
if they don't love you. So I agree with you. They really have to love you.
Yeah, that's what makes it remarkable at the end. And that, now you
I
said
agree.
one word extra to it is like how you love how you solve the problem. And that is,
Yep.
I think, a critical one because everybody, I've seen hundreds and hundreds of enterprise software companies right now that virtually always have the same functionality because you need to build the table stakes to do a number of things. So they all have the same. And that's what customers typically look at because no one tells them it's not about the functionality, it's about the approach that someone takes to solve your problem.
Agree. Agree.
And that's where so much money is lost in enterprise sales, where they just focus on the features and not on the approach.
Agreed. And I think it goes back to you cannot satisfy everyone, right? Unless you develop a feature to the level that people will love it, you won't be able to have any traction. So, and you normally don't have the resources or the time or the creativity to solve every single feature at that level, right?
Yeah, that's
Maybe you
true.
can do that when you're a huge company like Apple, but most of us don't have that reality.
Exactly, and it's and even if you're a grown-up company and you have thousands of people and possibly even more, there will always be resource constraints. Although some people cannot even believe that, but it's the case. I mean, when I was at Unit 4, we had 300 people in Oslo. It wasn't enough, and a lot of people say, "Well, I would do with a tenth of that." So it's.
And I don't know. Maybe if we have Tim Cook here, he would say it's not even enough at Apple. We tend to believe
Exactly.
that because it's so big, but maybe they have the same resources
Of course, they have the
constraints at
same
the end of the
resources.
day.
It's all about choices. Yeah. So, fascinating. I want to kind of dig a little bit deeper into, okay, you're starting to develop a solution, 2000. It's healthcare. You realize also that it's you need to be sort of in the whole, ingrain yourself in the whole workflow that deals with employees, with the doctors, with the insurers, with the patient, and these kind of things. One of the things that I read about a quote that you highlighted, I'm not sure where it was. It said, in healthcare, having a great product isn't enough. You need a business model that can reshape the system. Tell me about it.
So the thing is, healthcare has been designed over decades, right? I think maybe if you go back to whenever Blue Cross Blue Shield was founded, I think it was in the 1930s. And it has been built stuff over stuff, right? Marginally stuff over stuff. So at this point, it's thousands of layers deep, and it has been built in at different stages. So it's not completely designed from scratch. If we thought about healthcare from first principles today, we would do something completely different. But you have to live with what's there, right? And this is a huge industry. You're not gonna, replace the whole industry for something entirely new. That's a very interesting academic exercise, but it's impractical with the amount of resources a startup has. So you need to really find a problem that is big enough and someone that cares about it. And I think that's what actually separated Axenia from all the others health techs, and there are plenty of health techs solving relevant problems in the world, but most of them go under because they cannot find someone that actually cares about the problem enough to fund it. And we have actually bought some health techs which had the right tool. The software was amazing, but they couldn't actually sell it to anyone. So unless you focus about that, and that's another reason to focus on, a small population and someone that cares, you won't be able to survive. You won't be able to go through the cycle of raising money and executing, which you need to actually create a company, right?
But what have you then done specifically to your business model to make it stand out, or to make the product and the business model
Well,
come together super sticky?
so we changed, we basically changed who we were offering this to, and no one was offering this to the employers in Brazil. And you have to understand how Brazilian healthcare works. Basically, the employers are the ultimate payer of the system. They buy insurance for their population. They don't control their population because most employees don't really want to give their employers data about their health. So they have very little tools to actually do something, even if they were, most employers are well-intended, but people don't trust them. And they are afraid that they will be singled out or that they will lose their job if they find out things or things like that. So that particular place, no one was targeting, and I believe that's what we found at Axenia, that those people actually are willing to pay for a solution, and no one is offering there because people are going to the doctors, or they're going to the patients, or they're going to the insurers. No one is thinking about, where is the money coming from, really. And I
Exactly.
think
It's the undertones.
that's what changed us. And so we decided to change the way they were acquiring healthcare. So normally healthcare, you buy it through a broker, and the broker charges you about 5% of whatever you pay. So obviously the broker has an incentive for you to pay more. So they will, if you actually spend more, you pay more, and therefore the broker actually gets benefited. We switched that. We basically told, we can become a broker, but we can also manage your population. And we won't change anything for the brokerage, but we will take some money if we actually manage to get you a discount in your
Interesting.
insurance payment. And that's what changed it.
Interesting. That's what also what I saw. Because I mean, when people think startup, they think, okay, these guys, they're creating a product and it's hard enough to get it to market, and then you grow and grow, and at some point you start maybe thinking about expanding. But if I see the journey is 2020, the company founded, 21 seed funding, 22 merged with HealthCo, which is a data intensive healthcare broker. Then you get another capital injection again. Then you acquire a company in 23. So it's a completely different trajectory that people expect.
And it was difficult to fund because when you go to the funds, they would always tell you, no, we don't do M&A, you're too small for that, and things like that. You just have to think from first principles and trust that someone will understand it. And it means that you have to go and talk to hundreds of investors, and maybe one will believe you. I was lucky, frankly, that this was not my first startup, because
And you've been working for companies like Advent.
and I had a little bit of money of my own, so I could fund some of those, and I actually invested money in every single round. So that gives you a little bit of credibility when you tell people, give me $500,000 and I'm going to put 200,000. It's a different story. So I think that helped to go through a different channel. But I think it was mostly having the courage of being different and say, no one does this as a small company. Yeah, but it's the way to do it. And I always very, very surprised by investors in those sets, because you are in a field where 9 out of 10 investments actually fail. So why do you actually care that I do the same as the rest? 9 out of them, they're going to fail. So why do you want to copy them? But unfortunately, investors, as you probably know as well, because you've been involved with them, they're not very risk takers. They're very conservative. So you have a big disconnect there between entrepreneurs, which are normally huge risk takers, and investors, which are actually very conservative.
Exactly. To that extent, of course, the VCs maybe are less risk averse, but they also can make a calculation that indeed maybe, well, 10, 9 out of 10 will fail, or even 99% will fail. So it's part of the whole calculation. But still, it's of course there's a lot of calculations to avoid any risk, ideally. Okay, going then into, okay, the company is growing and it's scaling and so on. One thing, of course, that you also know from your private equity days is, the company needs to also sustain on its own feet. You know, it need to be profitable at some point in time, and for that, predictability is very important. What has been your biggest challenge to get to predictability?
I think that we are very conscious about that, much more conscious than the typical startup. I was older when I started. I always was very focused on this company has to be cash flow positive. So every time we invest in a cycle where we, you know, invest for a while and we have to see the cash flow you know, relatively soon. Normally within a year, we continue to be cash flow positive and then invest in the cash flow positive again. And we go on those cycles. That's also not typical for a startup. The startups always try to, you know, get a lot of money and burn a lot of money and see what works. And I think that's probably worked for some people. I mean, probably not. It did work for a lot of people in a different context, where, you know, rates were lower and you know, it was much easier to raise money. If you do that now, I think the chances that you're going to be successful are not very high. So you really have to divide your ambition into small chunks that you can afford.
Yeah,
And
exactly.
that means that you're not going to do a lot of things. And that's well, that's right.
Yeah, that's again about making choices, and it goes back to the trait number one, for example, about you cannot please everybody. Trait number seven is focus on the essence. So there's a number of them there as well. What is the most counterintuitive lesson that you learned about scaling a business?
I think I'm not sure if it's counterintuitive, but it's very painful. The fact that companies at this stage grow faster than people, and in every single company I've had, you cannot hire people that are overqualified so that they will last you a lifetime because you don't have the money. And you will find that, you know, very good people that do a good job at a certain scale will just not be able to deal with the next step. And you always tend to believe that, you know, talent is forever, but it doesn't. You know, talent just has a limit in all of us, and you have to be able to either switch that people hopefully to someplace else, or put someone on top of them, or change them. And most of, you know, about 50% of the time is change them, and it's painful because you're changing people that are perfectly capable and did nothing wrong. But unless you do that, and you know, continue to trade up your workforce, you're not going to get there. So I think that's very frustrating and very difficult to do.
It is exactly. It's yeah, but it's a reality, and you have to disconnect yourself from that decision at the end. You know, it's not a personal thing. At the end, it's about the business need to go on. One of the things that I also read about you that intrigued me is about control versus flow. I'm not sure what exact quote was, but it's you've learned about letting go and not trying to control everything. Just go with, well, take the flow as it is on a day-to-day basis almost. Has that got to do with that example that you just gave?
I guess a little bit. I remember that the day I said that, and I was probably in a more mystic mood, I guess. But I think so. I think that, you know, when you start doing this companies, you just have tons of variables, and a few of them you have the resources to control, or the ability, or the energy, and a lot of them you don't. And you know, especially when you come from, and I was an engineer. I was really educated to control everything, and then McKinsey and places where you think, you know, unless you have perfection, you don't show anything to anyone. And you need to start understanding that you won't be able to have that when you're an entrepreneur. You will always have suboptimal solutions, So, and you will always, be ashamed of what you're showing because it's not up to the standards, but you have to show it at one point. And so I don't know, I can't remember the quote, but someone said something like, if you're not embarrassed from the first product you launched, then you're not going fast enough. And it's completely true. So
Yeah,
you have
exactly.
to learn to live with that, and you have to learn with the fact that you don't control things, that they're going to just come back to you.
Yeah. Means that also that, of course, that you have to unlearn a lot. Because, I mean, you just said
Yes.
as well that you've been working indeed for McKinsey and all these companies where all of these things sort of are, counterintuitive or not done or the other way around.
Yeah, no, I mean, every process of learning, it means unlearning something, but that's a big thing. Yes. I started my career basically believing that perfection was the aim, and now that you understand that if you reach perfection, you're just late probably. So you
Exactly.
don't have to reach perfection.
What is a key metric or maybe key metrics that you thought were very important, like say 5 years ago, that today is like, no. I've learned the game. Something is the most important thing is this.
It's interesting. I think that 4 years ago we were very focused on getting traction, and traction was pretty much everything, and it was what everyone was asking, right? So how many lives you have and all that. I think that what we see today, it's a lot about how much data we have and how much different data, so that it's relevant to our algorithms that we have. So it's a variation of that. The volume it's still important, of course. And you can always solve, with brute force, you can always solve lack of variety or things of that sort. But we think a lot now about, what kind of data we are getting, and is it adding to what we understand of a problem, much more than sheer volume.
Interesting that you say that, because that is typically about creating your moat.
I agree. When you write when your company is a data company, you're basically creating your moat two ways. You either have tons and tons and tons of data, or you have better models, and you have to build both to actually build them up, right? You have to have better models and tons of data. I think that what we learned is that at the beginning we thought the volume was everything, and that's a part of the solution. It's not wrong. But your ability to build models is also very important, and you can build both at the same time if you pick the right data, not only a lot of data.
Yeah, exactly. Funny enough that you say that we are, if you're a data company, because my perspective up to now was, yeah, you're a software company, and of course, data is part of the solution.
I don't think that way. I think we are mostly a data company, and
Yeah.
software is part of the solution.
Isn't that fascinating? So how is that different then in terms of what is the significance about turning that around?
I think software, the tools with which we analyze data change so fast
Yeah.
that if you focus on software and marginal advantages of software, you are gonna be left behind. So we throw software to the trash like every 6 months. I don't think, if you go through our code, you won't find a line there that has more than a year. And it
Wow.
doesn't mean that what we did before was useless. It just means that we learned and we transfer that into a new model. So I don't think that we build software as much as we treat data with software.
That's a key insight. Looking at the time, I've got two more questions. From your experience building the business now, but maybe also like from all your experience before starting, creating the company, what has been a big lesson that you've learned back then that you still benefit from today?
I think, the one thing that has served me from day one, and I still keep, is never keeping anyone in the dark. I think that the one thing that I'm always very, very careful is about, keeping your investors ahead of the bad news, making sure that they understand why you did something that didn't work, and things of that sort. I think that creates a level of trust that pays off in the end. So no one wants. was bad news. But if you keep them to yourself, it's going to be much more difficult over time to build a relationship where they
Exactly.
invest in you.
Exactly.
So I think that was kind of innate in me, I guess. But I think it worked through private equity, it worked through public markets, and it still keeps going today. So I would say that's something that has served me a long time.
Do you also have a sort of a model for that, or a principle within your company to share a lot of information with everybody in the company? Because I sometimes hear people
I
say
agree.
we share everything with everybody.
That's a nice thought. You cannot share everything with everybody. Let's be really clear. I mean, there are things that you know, they're a trade secret. There are people that are not performing, and you want to change them, and you cannot tell them that you're going to change them, you know, ahead of time. So there are many things that you cannot really show. I don't think that's. I mean, Google is famous for doing that, but I'm pretty sure that they don't tell every employee their earnings report before they publish it, right? So I think that it's a nice idea. I think that what you can do with your company and with your employees is making sure that you're never going to lie to them. So if you cannot tell them something, you tell them that you cannot tell them.
Yeah, that's
And
true.
that creates, again, it's about trust. Trust is not necessarily about telling everyone everything all the time, but making sure that they understand why you cannot share some things. But other than that, yeah, I tend to communicate more than less, and I tend to, what we call it communicate rhizomatically. So it means that, you know, anyone can communicate with everyone in the company. You don't have to go through a boss or through anyone else, and that goes for the investors as well. So if investors want to call up any of my of the people in my company at any time, they can, and they do, and everyone
Innovative.
knows that they have to tell the truth all the time. Even if it's about news.
Yeah, I like that principle. Last question then. If you would share a do and a don't to peers, other CEOs that are building a software company, what would it be?
I think the do is be very careful about who you actually pick as your co-founders. They are going to be there for a long time. Sometimes you have to change them. I had to go through that. It's very painful. It's very difficult for the company. It destroys the culture. And sometimes you haven't spent enough human time with them to understand, you know, how are they going to work when we are on the brink of you know, going under, or you don't have money or things like that. You tend to pick your co-founders because they have capabilities that you don't have, and that is important. But I think it's much more important that you share, you know, the vision of how you're going to go together through the bad times, and that's something that definitely you have to do. My personal don't is don't follow the crowd. Again, the thing we're discussing, you know, 99 out of 100 people in this business are going to fail. Crowds mean nothing. You know, you're right. I think this is Warren Buffett, but I think you're right because your data and your analysis are right, and nothing else makes you right. It doesn't really matter what the else may
Exactly.
believe, and unless you live by that, you're not going to build something different. And if you don't build something different, you're very small to be better. Right, as I was saying, Marsh is a lot better than me. You know, I'm not gonna be able to be better than Marsh at their game. I can be different though.
Yeah, exactly.
And by being different, you have to think differently.
Fantastic. Wise words to that to end this podcast. Thanks for sharing all the wisdom.
Oh, thank you so much.
And yeah, it's fascinating how you've built a company in the last 5 years, and I'm really eager to see where you will take it in the next five. So let's plan another podcast in 2020, well, no, in 2030. So,
Excellent, excellent. I'll pencil it right now, right away.
okay. Thank you very
Okay.
much. And this wraps up my conversation with Mariano Garcia Valeño, founder and CEO at Xenia. If you got value from this episode, please share it with other SaaS founders who need to hear this as well. And if you got 10 seconds, a quick rating or review on Apple Podcasts will help more people to find these conversations. Thank you for listening to the Remarkable SaaS podcast. If you want more insights like this, subscribe to my daily email, Espresso with Ton. It's a 2-minute shot of clarity for SaaS founders who want to create pull, not push. You can sign up, along with getting my book, at valueinspiration.com. See you in the next episode.